Good morning. This is Quinn Kelsey, formerly from Honolulu, Hawaii. Been living 15 years in Chicago now. Don't ever get to see home because the opera business has me traveling pretty much all over the world.
Where are you from these days?
These days? Well, the mail goes to Chicago, but ask me how often I actually get to see it, so much so that one of the first things I have to do when I get home to Chicago is to do lots of laundry and clean up, because the apartment is basically like I've never been there.
Right. It's probably like, you know, Harry Potter after that mail comes
in.
Oh,
I'm so sure. You know, I need all my spells for getting rid of the dust and you know, cleaning out the shower because it's had months of mildew because nobody's been using it. And but it's home. It's Chicago represents the last big chunk of my development as an artist, and so I really do love it. You know, when friends and colleagues say, "Oh, and when we have this time off, we're going to go travel here, and we're going to see this," and I say, "Okay, that's good. I'm just going to go home." But why? Yeah, because I see it all when I'm working. Let's see. I was in, for just to give you an example, I was in Fort Lauderdale in Miami on vacation, and then left Miami for Switzerland for 3.5 weeks in Zurich.
Wait, you were on vacation.
I was on vacation
so
in Florida.
So what were you doing?
Whole lot of not singing. We left out of Miami to Zurich for 3.5 weeks because I was on, I was a part of their the Zurich Opera's production, a current production of La Traviata, a production that I helped to premiere in the spring of 2015. Gave myself a huge happy birthday that year because I was on a plane for eight hours on my birthday, going, "Yay, happy birthday!" I guess.
Has there been a year when you haven't done Rigoletto recently?
I think so. And so that whole year I was kind of slightly confused. What? Well, you mean there's no Cortigiani this year? Oh, okay.
Hey, but I'm so excited. Wait, now. So you've already done the German, the Traviata, but there's a new production coming up, isn't there?
There's a new production coming up at the Met this fall.
And you're in it.
And I'm in it. And actually, the two productions that I'm doing this fall and winter, back-to-back, the Met's traditional Aida runs the end of September through the latter half of October, and then the brand-new Traviata runs the entire month of December. And then, as I say with these revivals, the Met is the only company who really have the resources and the turnover to be able to have, I mean, it's not even a revival, but the whole production of Traviata, for example, is cut up into three chunks.
Hey, but this is so, what's New York to you now?
You know, New York was definitely the mecca of sorts for young singers. You know, everybody had it in their head that, oh, I've got to get to New York. I've got to go to New York because everybody auditions in New York. You know, all the companies come to the Met, and so they have their company auditions. All the management, all the big management companies are in New York, and so it's the place to be for young singers. But it's not easy to be in New York because it's expensive, not just to live, but also to be able to afford to do all the auditions, you know, because you have to, if you don't have to pay for a space to rent, you have to pay for the accompanist. And sometimes the auditioners require some kind of fee. So young singers have it so terribly difficult because of all the things that you have to afford before your career actually takes off. And this is one of the things that they don't always tell young singers. Oh yeah, by the way, you need to be able to have 20,000-30,000 on the side just to be able to use.
Just to be able to audition.
Just to be able to audition. And then God forbid you have to travel somewhere else to audition, you know, or if you're not in New York, that you have to tack on flights, cabs, accommodations. And so thankfully, from the time I left Hawaii until the time I was a studio member at the Opera Center at the Lyric Opera of Chicago for 3 seasons. And because it was already far away enough from home, there was no reason to go back home. And Chicago was so well situated in the middle of the country that it wasn't so hard to get around. And I realized that I said that you have to remember that it costs money to do all the traveling for auditions, but that I'd been taken care of pretty well in Chicago. As a studio member, they actually paid you sort of like an employee, quote unquote.
And wow, so now realizing as you look at what a singer's got to go through, what a leg up that Chicago Lyric Opera was.
Huge. Huge.
Mm-hmm. Opportunities, connections.
All of it. And the financial backing. So that when I mean, in the middle of being a young artist, I could feasibly afford to go and make those auditions in New York and elsewhere. And so, yeah, I know sometimes people don't like to use the word, or think that it's the right word, but I in so very many ways have been blessed, at least this last chunk of development from the time I left Hawaii until the time I considered myself to have become a full-fledged working artist.
People listening, a lot of them are going to wonder how you made that leap from Hawaii boy to Lyric Opera protege.
One of the things I've been discussing at length with certain people recently is the fact that I feel like those of native Polynesian background period have kind of a leg up on everyone else in terms of classical and in terms of singing period, because the Polynesian culture is very oral, you know, Hawaii, Tahiti, Aotearoa, Samoa, Tonga, all very huge oral tradition. And so I have classmates, colleagues, you know, I've known young singers here while I was still at UH who for whom classical singing was very, I mean, not easy, but considerably easier than most. But then the majority of those hit a wall when it was time to consider the fact of, you know, leaving the rock. And none of them could do it. One colleague of mine who was also part Hawaiian, Jordan Shanahan, we sang in the opera chorus together in the beginning of school, and then he changed his majors from trombone to voice when he figured out that he had a voice, and then left home to go and study in Philadelphia, and is a working singer in Switzerland now. Just the way it all happened, and he sings all over. He bases out of Switzerland, and he sings around mostly Switzerland and Germany.
Opera. Mm-hmm.
But he's like mm-hmm. the one from here, the only one from here recently that I know of. Mm-hmm. And all the rest of them had great talent, but couldn't conceive.
So it was a decision you made.
Very much so.
What was that decision?
It was just what was I to do next? What
did you do?
decided to leave.
And went
decided
where?
To connect to disconnect that umbilical.
Where'd you go?
And we just went straight to Chicago. I got into a couple really good programs right at the end of UH days. There was one program in Western New York State, about 4 hours south of Buffalo, called the Chautauqua Institute, an opera company and more of a summer school program led by big time music staff at a lot of the big music schools in New York and Philadelphia. And Deanna actually was a part of the opera program there 2 years ago. So I went to visit her, and it was kind of a crazy homecoming because I hadn't been back to that part of the world in 15 years.
So these music institutes and summer programs end up being these concentrated, intensive
yes.
opportunities to show your talents
right.
and meet other people who are equally committed. And, you know, Hawaii people just got to get to those.
Well, and so, for example, when I finished high school, I had no clue what I was supposed to do next. I mean, I knew that, I mean, for, you know, the people who know me know that, I mean, I basically grew up in music because of my parents. And, but still had to make the conscious decision as to, okay, what am I actually going to do with this? And music was always, it was such a no-brainer, but a part of me actually felt self-conscious, felt like I was in a way going to be cheating everybody else if I went into music, because it was just, because it was so second nature that I felt bad.
What, shouldn't you be working a little harder at what you're
well,
doing?
Well,
or
shouldn't I be
know.
Doing something else because, you know,
this
he's always
easy.
Been in music. And I never wanted to say it was too easy, but just that I needed to be sure that I was 110% going after what I was made for. So I took some other stuff in my first year in university. I took marine biology. I like digging under rocks in the water. I took Hawaiian studies, you know, one quarter Hawaiian. Feel very connected to my heritage and my family. Took visual art because I like to paint, like to draw. But, you know, music was just too strong. Besides the fact that, you know, I was getting into all the upper level music courses and workshops and things because I couldn't always explain what it was, but I knew how to do it. And so gave myself that first year because then I had to declare major after that and said, okay, you know, I like all these other things, but singing is in my blood. And that pretty much decided for me. So I stayed home, you know, wasn't going to have to spend as much money because I was home for school. Tuition was half, apparently, of what it is now. And I thought, I'll just start school here. And then if something else better comes along, I can always transfer. But then I haven't wasted any time. I don't have to start over again. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made. I was hired as a soloist at Century Union my second year. And if my buddy Jordan Shanahan hadn't left to go to Philadelphia, he would have gotten that job. He was in line ahead of me. But he left, and they told me, they said, well, we were thinking of Jordan first. And I was like, you know, good job, brah. Have fun in Philly. And that gave me two big oratorios a year, Messiah at Christmas and then something else in the spring every year, as well as, you know, the 2 day a week quick fire music sight reading and you know, harmonizing
just for church services?
Yeah.
I didn't even know this existed.
Well, but just that having to learn new music every week, caused me to have to build up that strength of reading music quickly and knowing how to hold sing my own part and not double somebody else. So that helped that side of my musicality. And then Hawaii Opera Theater started the Mae Zinke Orvis Opera Studio.
Whoa.
And I don't know that I would have gotten all that attention, that much attention on both sides of my musicality, per se, if I'd gone away to school. Because with the Orvis Opera Studio, they had a kind of a collab with the symphony. I'm not sure if they still do it now. If the symphony brought in some big name singer, they would do a Friday night concert and a Sunday matinee, and then the opera studio would get their hands on them for a Saturday night masterclass. So I did masterclasses with Marilyn Horne, Denise Graves, an American tenor named Anthony Dean Griffey, the late Jerry Hadley, and then as well as all the work with the Opera Center from San Francisco. Got to know them very well until the point that they were inviting me to go and audition for the summer program, the Marilla program. I met the guy who would become my boss at the Opera Center in Chicago because they got a hold of him. His name was Richard Perlman. You know, assistant director for Zeffirelli. You know, very, very extensive work on his own as a director. And then H.O.T. brought him to do Mozart things, Mozart recit work and things like that. I just don't know that I would have gotten all that kinds of attention if I'd gone away to some other school.
Yeah, he might have delivered a lecture in a hall somewhere or something like that.
And so because of all of that, I was connected to the Chautauqua program, went there for 7 weeks, and as you say, very, very intense and a little daunting sometimes just to have all that information being thrust upon you at the same time in 7 weeks. Auditioned for the Marilla program in San Francisco that fall after the Chautauqua program. Got in, was accepted at Christmas of that year for the following summer. Went to San Francisco the summer of 2002 and finished my last UH class kind of online before it was online. Finished the Marilla program. They used to do a tour with people from the Opera Center in the fall. We were the last year that they toured, and we did Boheme, La Boheme, from San Francisco all the way up to Washington State, across to Idaho, back down to the North Bay. We spent 3 days in Las Vegas at the Luxor because they worked out a show that was just over the border in Utah, and so it made sense to kind of base out of Las Vegas, and it's Las Vegas. Back across to Torrance outside of LA, 1 week off, and then we all flew back to Pittsburgh, where the tour bus was waiting for us, jumped over the border into Ohio to do one show, and then basically went straight out through Pennsylvania, up through New York, through Connecticut, and we ended up in Providence, Rhode Island, and then basically took the coast, the East Coast, all the way down and ended up in Florida. And then the company ran out of money, so they had to stop that program.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
came home to a workshop being led through the opera studio by Mark Morash, who's the music director of the Opera Center in San Francisco. Graduated the end of that year. Got to do my first full-on stage La Boheme with H.O.T. as kind of a, you know, aloha no kind of a thing. Packed up boxes and went to Chicago. And that was 15 years ago.
God.
And you know, made my Met debut in the spring of 2008. After that, it was San Francisco. I mean, there have been a lot of great debuts
Covent
since
Garden
then.
Last year.
Covent Garden, the Bastille in Paris. Mm-hmm. You know, Switzerland came, as I say, early in 2013. And now here we are. You know, I look at my schedule and I'm booked at least two solid years in advance.
Does that feel good?
Very. Mm-hmm. You know, because there is no job security in this business. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no plan if an opera company has hired you and suddenly have to file for Chapter 13. You know, you have no security. They don't have the money and they're going under and you have nothing to fall back on.
Well, that's a very real eventuality in this business, isn't it? I think we should talk about that.
We should. But so 2 years out, you know, I can look at my schedule and see. And it's not solid, but I haven't had any event where I've had a contract canceled. So, you know, knock on wood, thank the lucky stars.
Whatever. As you look across the opera firmament on Earth, where do people love it the most? Where is it happening the most?
You know, it's happening very well in North America, in the U.S. and in Canada.
What cities?
All the big ones: San Francisco, New York, Seattle, Chicago.
Who are the audiences?
Audiences are mostly older people because it seems to me that older audiences just have that blanket appreciation for the art form. You know, younger generations are just not brought up for the appreciation of it. You know, when everyone who was, you know, mid-50s and older were little kids, there was a lot more of that around. You know, it wasn't the popular music wasn't this, you know, loud electronic stuff that I do listen to sometimes.
You know, you look back, Deanna, maybe this is a good point to draw you in because, you know, let's talk a little bit about the opera scene around the world, its future, who's listening now and where it's going to go. Deanna, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, good morning. My name is Deanna Pauletto, and I'm an Italian-Canadian mezzo-soprano from just outside of Toronto. And did you want me to answer your question?
No.
You know, just join in, would you, with Quinn and on this subject? Where, you know, how's opera in Toronto?
It's pretty good. We have a pretty big company in Toronto, and it's pretty popular. They put on about
six
productions a year, and they bring in some really great international stars. And they have a wonderful young artist program, and they give young Canadian singers a chance to be on the main stage, and a wonderful chorus as well. And it's pretty popular in Toronto. And there's also small little regional companies that are also very, very good. And I think that Toronto's a great city culturally.
Just Toronto,
and
Canada.
Well, Canada, we have, I mean, I think Toronto is the biggest, but there is, Montreal has a great opera company, Vancouver, Manitoba,
really?
Saskatchewan. Yeah, yeah. Calgary's got a big one as well. Yeah, surprising. Yeah.
What kind of works do they do? I mean, okay, let's look at the repertoire, guys. I got both of you here now. How is this repertoire, give me your perspective on it. You know, the pieces that are most often done, how companies are sort of like, you know, paint themselves into corners to having to do certain kinds of repertoire. Reflect to me.
I think in Canada, They tend to do the operas that are quite popular. A lot of the Italian opera, some of the German, you know, the opera that people are very familiar with and that they know that they will have a good attendance, a number of people coming
out. Is
there
a future for opera, just doing those?
I think that at least the majority of their season will be of that sort of opera because it's popular and it'll keep attracting people. And then once in a while they'll throw in, I think, a couple
more obscure
stuff just to give it a try and see how that works. I know that we had one big Canadian production. I think Gordon Lightfoot was the composer, and they put that on at the COC, and that was kind of a weird thing.
Well, isn't the guy who's I can't think of his name. Hallelujah.
Leonard Cohen.
No. The modern singer guy, who really brought that out.
Oh yeah, I know. I know what you're talking about. Sorry.
But isn't the COC commissioning something?
They're doing something.
By like a modern guy who's only like, I don't know, maybe.
Do you like to sing 50s? Those kinds of things?
You know what? It's kind of harder for me. I appreciate it, but I definitely have colleagues who enjoy pursuing the modern stuff, who like getting hired for brand new things that have never been done. You can ask this one because she just did a modern piece in Germany at the beginning of this year, but I guess I'm just too traditional that I prefer melodies and things that you can hum later on because they've stuck in your head, whereas you know a lot of this more moderny kind of, I mean I guess the modern stuff that I like is the stuff that sounds like movie music, you know, like the contemporaries of Star Wars orchestration and stuff like that. And so I guess I have to think of it
you
in,
like
in that way.
You like the stuff that people like to listen to.
I do.
Right.
You know, but Deanna did a modern piece this spring, and I mean, she was so prepared. It was only about an hour, but I applaud her very much for being able to stick with it and see it through to the end, because I just don't know that I could have done that, you know. And so, it's a lot. It really is.
It is.
Was it ever enjoyable?
I think after I learned it, finally, after it took me a while, I started to start to make it your own, and there becomes this natural musicality that becomes part of it. And then I said, if I have to find something to like about it, or I just won't enjoy singing it. So I did by the end, and I didn't actually enjoy my part. And it's funny, it was in Arabic, which, you know, that's not a singing language, really not one of our major singing languages at all. So it was a great challenge for me, but very satisfying once I performed it. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe I actually did this.
Yeah.
It was a great challenge.
In Arabic? Mm-hmm. No, this sounds really wild, Tiana.
It was quite wild.
Huh.
Right, yeah.
And back to repertoire and opera companies. You think they're doing well across the country?
I know for a fact that there's enough interest in it, you know, that people are going to watch. I know that, and this is only my opinion, but I glean that the Met will lose audiences in the house whenever they broadcast to the theaters, because they show operas, they show their operas in the theaters in Manhattan, you know, in New York. And so I understand that, you know, why pay 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 something, 200 bucks a seat to be in the house when you can go to a movie theater and pay a fraction and have your popcorn and your drink at the same time.
What's the answer to that, Quinn?
Well, I mean, right off the bat, I would... I mean, I have no clue what their financial plan is at whatever, but and I know a lot of my colleagues feel similarly that if you didn't allow the movie theaters in the immediate area to do it, then of course obviously it would force people to come back. I mean, the problem is that everybody's been spoiled now. There are movie theaters that have the Metropolitan Opera posters in Europe saying that, okay, you know, it's going to be one night, but you can come and watch a Metropolitan Opera in our movie theater. So I think it's generally a great program. I just feel like they've spoiled audiences, you know, in Manhattan, in the five boroughs, by allowing them to just go down the street to their movie theater instead of coming into the city. And it's not just being there in the house to see it and hear it, but it's, for me, it's kind of a tradition, kind of a thing, you know. That back in the olden days, opera was something special. It was like, you know, special going out to eat night kind of thing, you know. You dress up a little better than you normally would, you know. Wear nice loafers and long pants instead of shorts and slippers or bare feet, and you know, clean up just a little bit more because it's special. It's fancy.
You look forward to it.
Yeah, you know, you feel good about walking in, and oh, everybody else is dressed up a little bit too, mm-hmm. and some people are dressed up a lot. But it's I think. And I know society has changed. I know trends have changed and things, but I don't think it's so difficult to maintain that, and it's not high class, but just a slightly more advanced or you know, like I said, like special occasion dinner out, you know. And that's kind of all that needs to happen. Just the almost the illusion of high class, you know. Just as you say, to look forward to it, you know, to look forward to how other people are dressed, and just to feel slightly more fancy. And that's it, you know. And it just and then I think all it does is it maintains the thought of you know, slightly more grown up behavior, and without really going overload, you know, so that people don't, you don't want people to ever
need rules.
Yeah, you don't want them to dread having to adhere to a certain standard. So more so, it's just elevating the standard just a little bit. You know, don't wear a t-shirt, wear an aloha shirt, you know, comb your hair. but you know what I mean? So it's not, you don't have to go in thinking, oh, I'm supposed to wear a suit and a tie or formal wear. Mm-hmm. No, people who want to do that, they're going to do that. Or they do that for special, for opening nights or big gala concerts and things. Gala. We had this discussion last night. But more so I guess that's what it is, just elevating the standard, you know, just so that people, so that it's all encompassing. Oh, we're going to Blaisdell tonight. Oh, we're going to Hawaii Theater. Oh, okay, so we just gotta, as I say, not overkill, not dreading what you need to do to go there, but just, you know, to make people feel good about it, to make them excited about wanting to go. And that's it. You know, HOT started the OFE program 1992, 93. I started in 91, and then I pulled out the next season because the schedule was so crazy because I was in middle school, and the idea of having to stay up until 11 o'clock, mm-hmm. finishing rehearsal, and then go home. So I had to pull out for the next season. And then right after that, they started their intern program, which allowed, among other things, high school students to join the opera chorus. Because before that, it was just for adults. And so I weaseled my way in 1991, and that's for another conversation. But so suddenly I had the opportunity to formally be a part of the opera chorus. I could just audition like everybody else. And the only difference was that high school students had to audition every year because technically your voices are still maturing. And the Opera for Everyone program also meant, among other things, is that school students could have access to their own performance, in a sense. And so the final dress rehearsal was the OFE performance. And it's still, you know, it still happens to this day. And I remember in the thick of it, when it really picked up, students felt like $1 million because it was like the performance just for them. So I remember that they would send the company dioramas of all the pictures they took that night, and it was like prom. You know, the girls dressed up in nice gowns, the guys dressed up in, you know, suits and ties and stuff like that, and you just saw on their faces that they were so excited that, you know, that they could be the adults at the opera on their own night. And they were the best audiences. We'd come out for bows and we felt like rock stars because they would scream and they would cheer during the performance. You know, they
get the reactions.
Yeah, it was raw. They would laugh. They would gasp. You know, they wouldn't boo, but you know, they would groan at the villain. I mean, it was.
Does this all help, do you think? I mean, do you ever worry for opera in your town? In your hometown, do you worry that this art form?
I don't worry. I just know that we're at a point across the country, where popular music is such a force. And so those in classical music, not just opera, but classical music in general, have to do so much more work to reach out to younger audiences, to reach out to audiences in general. I think, you know, people have asked this question before, you know, what's going on with Hawaii, with opera, opera classical music in Hawaii. And I think Hawaii has a specific dilemma. And in my opinion, it's that local culture is just so strong. You know, everybody loves having their big parties and, you know, catering all the Chinese food and all the gaoji, you know, all the music that comes with it, you know, all the modernish Hawaiian music, you know, the local music with all the reggae background and stuff like that. But it's not just that. I mean, just, you know, all of the local, the heavy local culture stuff. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it's so strong in Hawaii. You know, all the local, every, all the things that come under the definition of local culture. And it's just, it's so much. And local people are just, it's what defines them. You know, going to all the bon dance, going to all the big parties, you know, all the spam musubis and all the fried rice, and it's so strong. And so then classical music on the whole in Hawaii is so, I mean, it's so young because it hasn't been around in Hawaii so long as strong as the local culture has been. I mean,
how do you see getting some outreach here?
That's a great question. I mean, the education program in Hawaii is well known enough that it has been showcased in Opera News. And that's one of the best ways, I think, to reach the local population is through the kids.
Yeah.
You know, to get them into it, to get them inspired at an early age. And And I see how difficult it can be, you know, going to these public schools in Waimanalo and in Wahiawa, and they just don't have that kind of exposure to classical music. You know, they're not so interested in learning to play violin or to sing Haulikain music in choir. As much as they want to pick up their brother's ukulele and you know, go to a big luau. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. It's beautiful. It's just that classical music has this huge opposition.
Yeah, it's just lack of visibility. But I can see that you were able to leverage the opportunities that are here and still are here to do what you've done.
Well,
it's possible. You know, you're living proof. It's possible. You know what? I have to ask you about one more thing before we go.
Uh-oh. Though.
Talk to me about your instrument. Where are you at?
I think one of the hardest things for a fledgling singer is to completely know their instrument, you know, physically, physiologically. If you break your leg, if you break a bone, it affects your voice. If you get a really bad bruise somewhere, it affects your voice. I mean, obviously, if you get a cold, it affects your voice. But anything that happens to your physical body affects your voice, affects your larynx, because it's a part of your body. It's a living, breathing, blood flowing through it kind of thing. And so I think one of the most important things is to get to know your voice in every single way. Its strengths, its weaknesses, what works with it, what doesn't, you know, what you can and can't eat, what you can and can't drink, the amount of physicality you can have in any one day, you know, playing sports, hiking, swimming, or just, you know, how much physical pressure you can put on your body until your voice says, okay, pow.
What can you not eat?
I'm usually okay.
You slimmed down since.
Thank
lost.
You. Well, and that's another thing. You know, there are singers who won't drink coffee, won't drink a lot of carbonated stuff the day of a show. You know, water is generally the elixir of choice during the show because it doesn't have anything in it, but it helps a general lubrication of the mouth, the throat, the larynx. You know, people who won't eat any kind of cream or milk-based anything because of the way that it causes a lot of extra phlegm in the mouth and the throat. You know, getting out on stage going, you know, some people won't eat spicy foods beforehand because it, you know, or the kinds of foods that cause a heartburn or reflux, because that can really hurt while you're singing.
You must be starved after a performance.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, because you don't realize how much work you do, how much physical work you do, not just moving around, but just the energy that is used to make the noise itself. And yeah, 9 times out of 10, see, this is part of what makes it so hard to be an opera singer, because you're forced to function late into the night, you know, consistently. So number one, you finish a show after 3 hours, and you can't just, 9 times out of 10, you can't just go home and change clothes and get into bed and pass out, you know, unless it's been some kind of specific day, you've been up a long time. Usually, my colleagues and I need to go out and eat something or have something in the dressing room right afterward to eat, or just that there's enough adrenaline that's been pumping through your veins during the show that you're not going to wind down for at least a couple hours. You know, and so what do? You're just going to go home. You're going to be sitting there fidgeting and not being able to sit still. So it's, you know, you have to learn these things about your body, about the way that your body functions. And one of the hardest things is that it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in a week. It's not going to happen in a month or a year. You know, it took me, I was a studio member in Chicago for 3 years, but at least a couple of years after that, it still took until then to really begin to understand how my body functioned. And part of it, as you said earlier, is taking care of your body.
Where are you in the development of your voice?
I feel like at this point, if nothing else, because of the work that I'm getting, because of the people who are hiring me, I'm pretty much, I'm not dead center in the sweet spot of my career now, but I'm definitely in bounds of this, you know, meat per se of my career. Most of my work is repeat business, so I don't have to go and constantly learn new music. Mm-hmm. That will happen, but it happens about once a year, if that.
That's good.
Whereas everything else is all stuff that I know. I'm working at a lot of really great companies where they hire a lot of big stars, so it's nice to feel like I'm in that pool of singers. As I said, I'm never home, and it's a good thing. Because it means that I have a lot of work. I mean, it's always nice to get hired in Chicago, but it's just not going to happen every year, at least for the repertoire that I do. That my repertoire is pretty specialized, but a company like Chicago just can't afford to do my kind of repertoire every year. But it's okay because my schedule is pretty full. You know, Zurich, London, New York, San Francisco, Frankfurt, Germany. I've been to Norway. Gonna get to Vienna in 2 years.
Really, there's no better way to go there, right, than to do this work for which the town's so well known.
Exactly.
Jeez. Okay, Honolulu, you've got a concert coming up.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you have in store? What do you want to do with this concert?
Well, I just feel that I have a responsibility to get home as much as possible, just to show. Show the audiences that I've taken all of their support, all of the attention that I've been given when I was here growing up, and I feel like I've sincerely made something of it. If you know, all the big debuts don't speak for themselves. And it's home, and it's always going to be home, and so I feel like it's my duty to come home and help out however possible, you know, because I swear to you, the opportunities and the attention that I was given through the Opus Studio, I don't know if my path would have been so defined if I hadn't got all that specific kind of attention. I mean, I know myself well enough, and I would have sought it out, but again, I have been so blessed and been shown the path, whatever that means, so clearly, and it's yielded so much in my in, you know, the bit of my career that I've had. And so I feel like I need to make sure that I can come home whenever possible and give back.
How'd you choose the pieces that we'll hear?
It's the easiest thing to do for this concert was just to do all the you know, the top 10 well-known tenor, mezzo, and baritone arias. You know, and I wanted Deanna and her friend Richard to be able to come out. Richard had done a big concert in Toronto at the end of the spring and had invited Deanna and another friend of hers to join. And then because I was going to be in town to come visit, invited me to sing, what was it, two arias?
I think one aria.
Just one. One aria. I did one aria. I did a duet with him, the same duet that we will do at the concert. And then we did the quartet from Rigoletto.
Oh.
Just because we had all the voices.
Oh, God.
Wow. And so that made it such an easy choice to invite him and have her already here so that we could do this. And you know, I'm just happy that HOT agreed and then decided that they would push as much as possible so that we could offer two performances. You know,
on your old home turf.
Oh yeah.
I mean, twist
my arm, please. Well, because usually it's a one shot deal, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and so. I mean, as I say, twist my arm and give me more than one chance to get on a stage and in front of the hometown crowd and you know, make all the fun noises. So Deanna is a mezzo soprano. And one of her strengths is her coloratura. Mm. Yeah, I mean she just about fell over the fact that she got to meet one of her idols in Switzerland this summer, Cecilia Bartoli.
Oh no!
Yeah, and there are pictures.
Oh, really? There's evidence.
Yeah. And so one of her strengths is that kind of coloratura.
Okay.
And so among other things, she's going to offer a Rossini song that's not necessarily from an opera, but Rossini wrote it. It's called the Canzonetta Spagnuola. And the first time I heard it was on YouTube when she did a concert for Marilyn Horne at Marilyn Horne's summer program, the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara. And it's just, you know, it's such a simple song, but it's a mix of growing tempo and the ability to just move. And it's the combination is just thrilling. And so she's going to offer that.
Gee, I can't wait.
And then, so the plan was that we would just share arias, and then one duet each. So I'll do the Act One Don Carlo duet with Richard, and I just debuted that role in DC this spring, and so it's still very new, and it's very exciting for me that it hasn't settled, and not that settling is a bad thing, but that it just has that, you know, brand new shoes kind of feel.
Yeah, I'm glad we'll get a taste of that.
And then and then she and I will do the Rosina Figaro duet from the Barber of Seville, where I'm gonna have to keep up with her because I feel like my coloratura is not totally what it used to be while she's just kind of sitting there waiting for me. You know, it's like, come on. Richard is very much the classic Italian tenor sound.
Hmm. Richard, what's his last name?
I'm sorry, Richard Janello.
Mm-hmm.
He and Deanna know each other from...
Oh, from high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's gonna do arias from Tosca and L'Amico Fritz. But just that classic
right.
sound, you know.
Yeah.
You know, long pretty lines and it's just a quality that I don't think Hawaii audiences get enough of.
Wait, so let me think. You're gonna have a chamber orchestra?
No, the head of music staff at HOT, Mike Ka'i Nash. He's going to be playing everything.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And so we just kind of plan everything out and try to spread myself out as much as possible. Because I don't know if you remember, but the last concert I did at Hawaii Theater back in 2010, in the beginning of the year, and I put three big Verdi arias back to back. Well, two big Verdi arias and one Giordano, back to back. And that wasn't such a good idea. You know, I feel like I'm Superman sometimes, but. And so I learned my lesson real quick. So we'll spread it all out. There's a ton of Verdi. It's more so something that I get from my manager, you know, whenever I do art song programs. Well, no, you can't sing that. You can't offer that because you did that. You did that the last time you sang in Chicago. And nope, you did that as well. So it's about, I guess in a way it's about not looking like you're slacking off, that you're just cheating everybody. Oh, I'm going to sing this again. Yeah, but they've heard you sing it before. So, you know, so it's kind of a, you know, doing your due diligence to inspire the audiences on another level.
Mm-hmm. Surprises when we open that package.
Yeah. So there will be a lot of Verdi. I tried to stay away from the stuff that I did on that last concert and, you know, went back to old school days in college. I think there might be a Mozart in there as well as the Ballad of Baby Doe. just to kind of keep things nice and, you know. My father, the English professor. You know, whenever you can't think of the right word, I just have to blame him. Just to give a nice, you know, a nice smattering of different rep, and then on top of that, I don't want to forget, the three of us are being joined by local Hawaii favorite Leslie Goldman.
Mm.
She'll be singing "Glitter and Be Gay," and then because she's with us, we can do the Rigoletto Quartet again. So it'll be
good.
Oh yeah. Well, we'd started with the idea of 1 hour of singing, and everybody went, well, that's nice, but you know, we need to hear more of you. And I said, oh, okay. So that's when we opened up the aria books and things and said, okay, well, we can do that and we can do this, and then, you know, trying to shuffle things around so I'm not, you know, killing myself in the second half before the duet with her. And no, but it'll be good. We're all really excited, and it's gonna be good fun. Two performances, Friday the 24th at 7 p.m. and Sunday the 26th at 4 p.m. Is that right?
7:30.
Oh, sorry. 7:30 on Friday and 4 p.m. on Sunday.
Send me the whatever. Or do I have it? I may have it already.
I can follow.
Okay, great. Oh, we got it. Thank you so much.
No, it's good
to see
you.
This is our chance to check in with you, you know.
Yes.